Blog Talk Radio.
Thompson, and it's beautiful Colorado here today. Sun is out, the sky is blue, and you are on Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. Today my guests are David Cantor and Eric Kosh. My dear friend and co-host Krystalyn Beek Larson won't be with us today because she is in Orlando researching her wonderful project that will happen on an event she's creating that will happen on 11-11-11 next November 11th, 2011. And they'll be doing an angel assembly in Orlando, Florida. So she's in Orlando today. We won't have Krystalyn, but we do have David and we do have Eric. I've known both of these gentlemen for many, many years. They've been Urantia Book students of the Urantia Book for many, many years, both of them, probably between the two of them, close to 80 years of study with the Urantia Book, two scholars of the Urantia Book. And Eric is a professional videographer, and David works as a consultant in IT and web development. And so they have decided to do this project in Israel. It's called the Joshua Ben Joseph Project. And I'm going to let them tell you all about it. But first of all, I would like them to tell us a little bit about themselves. So David and Eric, welcome to the Cosmic Citizen.
Well, thank you, Paula. Eric, who are you?
Who are you, Eric?
My name is Eric Kosh, and I thought I would let David start off with his thing first because we've known each other so long, and then we'll talk about how we got involved in this project over 30 years ago, or the concept for it. So, David, I'm going to turn it over to you first, and since you've already been over there, and so conceptually, and since you've made some maps, I think it would be very cool if you would start, and then I'll just chime in.
Okay, well, my name is David Cantor, and I've been a reader of the Urantia Book since the late 1960s. I made my first trip over to Israel in the late 1970s, and since that time I've made a number of other trips over there and have a long time had a vision of creating a really good quality video companion for part four of the Urantia Book. And Eric and I first talked about this many, many years ago, possibly at the Lake Geneva conference. I'm not sure. And the idea has kind of just percolated in the background, and we finally have reached a point where we understand if we're going to do it, we need to do it. And so we're attempting to mobilize the resources that we can use to go and do this. You know, it's not just creating a video companion for part four for entertainment. We want to provide something that's going to stimulate students of the Urantia book, something that will expand their understanding of the context in which Jesus' bestowal took place. And this will include creating a new generation of maps that complement part four of the Urantia book. We hope to produce a fairly extensive archive of still photos, video clips, audio clips that other readers can use in their own production of their own outreach materials. And I'm hopeful that we can produce a program that readers can use to take out and introduce the Urantia book to groups in their own local communities. So it's an attempt to create resources for readers for their own use, their own personal growth, and for their own outreach efforts. You know, we bandy about in the Urantia movement the term training teachers and leaders. This project is aimed at creating some resources that those teachers and leaders can use.
Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, okay. Just to pick up on what David said, and I don't remember, David, if where it was that we first talked about it. I don't remember if it was Lake Geneva or Maine, but it was a long time ago, and we talked about the possibility of going over there and filming. And back then, of course, technology was pretty poor. Photographic technology was pretty good. I mean, you had film. The problem is that you didn't know what you shot until after you processed it, and it was very expensive. As far as video was concerned, video was just a child in the late 70s. So technology was so bad that in order to do something professional, you basically had to shoot it on film, and that was cost prohibitive. So David and I, over the years, kept talking about the technology is getting better and better with as far as video, and all of a sudden photography just jumped out of nowhere, and so technologically it became the opportune time for us to do this, and so that's one of the things that we've wanted to do so that people, when they with Urantia book students, when they read the papers, we're hoping to be able to fill in some of the blanks visually so that people can see what does the Sea of Galilee look like at a sunrise, rather than just having some of the religious programs that you see where they say, okay, this is where Jesus was born and this is where Jesus was crucified and this is where Jesus did this or did that. And a lot of it is just made up. So whereas with the Urantia papers, we have the ability to be able to actually pinpoint some of these locations and also just try to give a picturization of what people will see when they read the Urantia papers. And of course, we're going to do this in high definition, and we're going to make it available to basically anyone. We're going to make it available to study groups and to organizations, so that that serious students and just brand new readers will have a better picture of what's going on, and we're going to do this as documentaries. So it's going to be very, very cool. So David, back to you.
Well, you've kind of covered it there in terms of what we're doing and why we're doing it. There's another side to this of why we're doing it. And, Paula, can I just read a couple of quotes from the Urantia book?
Oh, absolutely, Dave.
This is from paper 196. This has been kind of my personal guiding thought about what we are attempting to do here. And let me read from the Urantia book. The time is ripe to witness the figurative resurrection of the human Jesus from his burial tomb amidst the theological traditions and the religious dogmas of 19 centuries. Jesus of Nazareth must not be longer sacrificed to even the splendid concept of the glorified Christ. What a transcendent service if, through this revelation, the Son of Man should be recovered from the tomb of traditional theology and be presented as the living Jesus to the church that bears his name and to all other religions. Surely the Christian Fellowship of Believers will not hesitate to make such adjustments of faith and practices of living as will enable it to follow after the Master in the demonstration of his real life of religious devotion to the doing of his Father's will and of consecration to the unselfish service of man. Indeed, the social readjustments, the economic transformations, the moral rejuvenations, and the religious revisions of Christian civilization would be drastic and revolutionary if the living religion of Jesus should suddenly supplant the theological religion about Jesus. To follow Jesus means to personally share his religious faith and to enter into the spirit of the Master's life of unselfish service for man. One of the most important things in human living is to find out what Jesus believed, to discover his ideals, and to strive for the achievement of his exalted life purpose. Of all human knowledge, that which is of greatest value is to know the religious life of Jesus and how he lived it. And the book goes on to say that the common people heard Jesus gladly, and they will again respond to the presentation of his sincere human life of consecrated religious motivation if such truths shall again be proclaimed to the world. And it is my hope that the work that we're doing will begin this process of presenting his sincere human life of consecrated religious motivation.
Well, you know, it's so beautiful, isn't it, Eric? I mean, the Urantia Book's recounting of Jesus' life is the most exquisite literature on the planet. I do not believe that there is a more beautiful piece of religious work anywhere than the Urantia Book. And the icing on the cake, I mean, the creme de la creme is the life and teachings of Jesus. It's this magnificent work that culminates in the retelling of this magnificent life, which was, obviously a revelation of God. Jesus in his own right was a revelation of God to our world. That's why we call it the New Testament, right? That's why, he really upstepped our way of looking at God as a father, as a loving, concerned Heavenly Father and not as an offended monarch. And so, part four is just it's so rich and so important. And one of the things that is amazing when you go to the Holy Land with the Urantia Book under your arm and you have this wonderful detail about where Jesus went and what he did, you know, the journeys he made, the routes that he took, the towns that he visited, and then you seek to find these places, and it's absolutely astonishing what you find. And, David, I went to Israel with you in 1994, and when you came back, you published all of your beautiful pictures of the Holy Land. And, of course, we put them up on Truthbook, and it was one of the most popular pages on Truthbook because people are curious about the Holy Land. They want to know all about it. They're interested in it. And it's the one and only time I've ever been there. And I just want to share a couple of my perceptions of the place. We spent 2 weeks there, as you'll recall. The first week we spent at a kibbutz on the Sea of Galilee. And the second week we spent in Jerusalem. And for me it was like every day we would go to see a place and we would read in the Urantia Book about Jesus and his experience with that place, whether it was, of course, all around the Sea of Galilee, Caesarea, Cana, all of those places, Nazareth. And we would read about that when we went to Caesarea Philippi and the headwaters of the Jordan. We read about that place on the way on the tour bus up there. When we went, to Golgotha, we read all about that. And it's very interesting how much disagreement there is in Israel about these places and where they were. And when you start, when you go with the Urantia book and you read those details, it leads you to places that you may not find otherwise. And I've heard some pretty interesting stories about that. So I just want to say thank you so much for taking this on. I know that you, it's quite an undertaking, and you have to raise quite a bit of money to get it done. But I trust you both in terms of your scholarship and your ability to do a really world-class job with this thing. And
well,
I know you will. I know it's going to be an end product that we can all be proud of and that we will all find very, very useful and interesting and insightful. So thank you so much for conceiving of it and holding on to that dream for so long that now you're actually making it happen. And that's exciting to me. It's a wonderful project. And I salute you both for doing it.
Well, thank
and
you so
I know,
much,
Dave,
Paula.
That you want to read. Oh,
yeah, I was just going to say that you know, sometimes when you jump into something like this or you first conceive of it, it's embryonic. It's a concept, but it just sits there. Remember in your Urantia papers, it talks about, you know, ideas versus actions. And I think that when David and I talked about this, it was sort of like a dream. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could do this? But at the time, as I say, it just wasn't right. Now, the energy that's happening right now with this project, it is very, very hard to put down in thoughts because it's happening so fast. It just seems like, you know, it just seems like everyone is ready to help us with this because it's going to take a lot of work. It's going to take a lot of work financially to put this whole thing together because it's everything from we have places that we want to go where we want to shoot with a helicopter. And most people realize, whoa, that's very, very expensive. But David, for instance, had checked just to see if we could get like 1 minute of footage from the Sea of Galilee. And David, correct me if I'm wrong on this. I think you came back and said it was like $1,200 or something for 1 minute of high def of the Sea of Galilee. Is that correct?
Yes, outrageously expensive, and also shot from kind of an evangelical perspective. I mean, it's just not even something. I saw the sample previews of some of those stock footage houses, and they just are not there. I know that you, Eric, are going to do a much better job than anything that's available on the from these stock footage houses.
Yeah, and this is something, again, David and I will make available to people because we're going to build this library. I'm pretty sure what we're going to do, no one has ever really done, not with the Urantia papers. Surely, yeah, there's film crews that have gone over there, and it's very commercial. And many times I've watched these programs, either on the History Channel or whatever, and I look at it and I almost laugh at it because it's just not real. You know it's not real. And so what we want to do is make this very, very real. There's an interesting thing when Paula was talking, and I know right after I say this, I think David would like to read something that in fact, it was when I first met David in 1981 at Snowmass, the first Snowmass. Before I get into that, I just wanted to give one quick thing on my history with the Urantia papers, which is kind of unique. I guess they all are. I first found the Urantia book in 1972, but I wasn't ready for it until 76. And when I saw it, the only thing that kind of turned me off, and this is going to be shocking in a way, but the thing that didn't jump out to me when I just perused the papers was the life of Jesus, because I came out of the church. I was born and raised into the Presbyterian church. My dad was an elder. And I had seen Jesus from the time I was 4 years old. I sang in the choir and did the whole thing. And I got into metaphysics. I got into just about everything that you can think of under the sun. I mean, Edgar Cayce, all of these things were lead-ups to the Urantia papers. And then when I got the papers, I was really into the first three parts of the book. That was the part that just blew me away to be able to think about Adam and Eve and about all the scientific discoveries and all of these things. When I got to part four, I was a little apprehensive. I know I would not have embraced the Urantia Papers without Jesus, but I didn't know if this was just going to be another Bible story. And it was the most incredible part of the book. And so it's sort of like, I think one person said it very well, and they said, parts one, two, and three are the life of Jesus, and the part four is how he lived that life. It was amazing how he did that. It was just incredible. So that was one of the things that I think that is going to transform this world are the life and teachings of Jesus as he truly lived it. So, David, I know that you have something that you want to read, which I also found as inspiring, that production that you put together back in 1981.
Well, okay, David,
go ahead and read this.
Well, before you start, I just want to say that there's a couple callers holding online. So we will take a couple calls.
You want me to go ahead and read this? This is about 5 or 6 minutes of material. It's beautiful material. If you want to take the callers, we can take them and read this later.
No, you go ahead and read that, and then we'll take the callers. I hope our callers can hang on for a minute here.
Okay, this is the most beautiful essay I have ever read about Jesus. It was written years ago by Vern Grimsley. He and I had produced a multimedia program called The Galilean. This was back in the days of slide projectors and dissolvers and film, if you can remember those days. But this is a wonderful piece, and I just will appreciate sharing it with you. I want to share it with you because I think this piece captures the kind of image of Jesus that I hope our productions can portray.
Beautiful.
The career and character of Christ were such that one out of every three persons on this planet today calls himself or herself a Christian. His name, Jesus, was the Greek form of the Hebrew Joshua. It is translated Savior. It was a common name in Palestine 2,000 years ago. Christ is from the Greek Christos, meaning the Anointed One or the Messiah. Scholars estimate that the entire Bible covers only about 50 days in the life of Jesus, and the first 30 years of his existence are hardly mentioned at all. And yet, the ideals of his life and teachings have dominated the art, literature, and the ethics of Western civilization for 20 centuries. Some 2,000 years ago, this Jesus of Nazareth was born, and since that time it is remarkable to consider that no king or general or statesman who ever lived has influenced the world as much and as little as he. As much because thousands have been spiritually transformed by his life and teachings, as little because millions who have heard his message have never dared to take it seriously. Most people know more of theories and theologies about Jesus than they know of Jesus' own life and teachings. Some have become so bored with the religion about Jesus that they have failed to find the real religion of Jesus. This Jesus of Nazareth came not to write a creed, but to teach a truth. Not to build a temple, but to help men and women discover the kingdom of God within themselves. Not only to tell us what we should be, but to tell us who we are, children of the living God, heirs to a vast kingdom which stretches from the portals of time to the frontiers of eternity. This Jesus of Nazareth came to thaw the frozen forms of human ideas about God into the liquid liberties of enlightened sonship and daughterhood with God. He lived and proclaimed that we can personally know God, that we do not have to settle for merely finding out about God, but can actually find God. He showed us that human life could become a thrilling spiritual adventure, that human strivings could be infused with divine purposes. Somehow God wrapped his heart in human flesh, and a man named Jesus came into the world. In the life of Jesus, God became visible. The deity was no longer an abstract conception, but a vital person. In the life of Jesus, theology became biography, and thus was the love of God revealed. The very heart that throbs at the center of this vast, star-shimmering universe of universes was somehow the heart that beat in the breast of this Jesus of Nazareth. But what was this Jesus really like? It was virtually impossible to be neutral about him in his own day. He was the most controversial figure of his time and of ours. Shepherds leaning on their walking staves with their backs to the burning sun would discuss him all afternoon. Their teeth would flash when they laughed to hear some passing traveler tell how the scribes and Pharisees in Jerusalem tried to trick him with a question and lost. Women talking at their village wells, their sandals gray with powdered dust, would tell of the Samaritan woman he asked for a drink one time and clucked their tongues at his indiscretion, for single men were not to speak to women thus. But then they would wonder what he meant by the water of life. When he told that woman about water which quenched the thirstings of the soul, how could this be? Some thought him a dreamer, and some a deliverer. People in the temple courtyards would debate his heresies. Young fishermen straining hand over hand with wet nets on the Sea of Galilee wondered if he could be the Messiah. Carpenters at their splintered benches, farmers plowing furrowed fields, young boys walking home from synagogue school, all talked about this strange new preacher and of those stalwart 12 who followed him. No one was neutral. And even in our day, as in his, each person must decide what to do about this Jesus of Nazareth. If somehow I could return and live one day with Jesus and the 12, I wouldn't choose the time he fed the multitudes, or even when he gave the Sermon on the Mount. I wouldn't choose the day he entered Jerusalem to the ringing of hosannas from the welcoming throng, or the day he died, or even the morning he rose again. No, I would choose an ordinary day, perhaps at one of their encampments in Galilee. I would love to watch him rising in the dawn-like duskiness of early morning and throwing a cloak across his broad carpenter's shoulders against the lakeside chill. Watch him walk through the coarse grass, heavily hung with cold dew. See him take a stick and stir the coals of the fire to bring them to life again. Hear him greet the apostles as they rose from their slumbers. See him eat, discuss, debate, ask questions. Observe him settling an argument, laughing with the children of those who came to listen to him speak. And then, after supper, I would watch from a respectful distance as he climbed a nearby hill to commune with the Father and draw strength for his mighty mission upon the earth. I would learn more watching him one day than I could put into practice in a lifetime. More patience, love, understanding, loyalty, strength, determination, joy, zest, and vitality than I could begin to assimilate. And yet the living spirit of this living Christ is real and present here and now. In this discovery lies the vital truth. Thick volumes of printed history divide ancient Palestine from the 21st century today. Yet many of our problems are still the same. And hence the need to hear today once more the words of Jesus that he uttered then, the words of confidence and assurance, which give people the power to live their lives with meaning and purpose. He lived, he taught, and he died. Political might, dominion, pomp, and power are always more impressive than the quiet teachings of truth. When Caesar Augustus died, you may be certain that all of Rome wore black for many days. The solemn sounds of muffled drums were heard along the flower-strewn pathway of his funeral march. Gold-glinting trumpets heralded the day of his death. The flutes and pipes wailed melancholy melodies. The very statues of the fallen Caesar were garlanded with flower blossoms in the public squares. 1,000 messengers rode horses foaming at the flanks to cry the news in distant provinces and protectorates that mighty Caesar has fallen, let all the world weep. Wet blades flashed red in silver sunlight as the priests of Rome with sacrificial swords gave offerings of blood and beast to the countless gods they served, for mighty Caesar had fallen, and all the world must mourn. But there was another who was born, who lived, and who died in the world of this Caesar Augustus. Or was it the other way around? Perhaps it was Caesar Augustus who lived in his world, the world of this Jesus of Nazareth who died by criminal execution, rejected by the religion of his fathers. The soldiers of Caesar gambled for his robe. His body was laid in a borrowed tomb. He died without ceremony, funeral or eulogy. Yet he's the one they remember, not Caesar, but Jesus of Nazareth. As a child he came to us, born of the womb of infinity, wrapped in the swaddling clothes of time and space. The sovereign of stars and smoldering suns he was. His hands had held the very planets in their paths. His fingers formed this glowing galaxy. He sprinkled the blackened sky with glistening beads of liquid light and hung the midnight with 1,000 diamond constellations, all linked like necklaces across the jeweler's velvet cloth. As a child he came to us, born much as each of us is born. But he lived among us as few have ever dared to even try. In Jesus we caught a glimpse of God as neither prior nor since seen, and we have not forgotten it. The world can never be the same again, for we have seen what God is and have seen what we can be.
Wow.
David, that was absolutely beautiful and read so beautifully. Wow, thank you so much. I mean, I just felt that. I felt that go out. And so well written. You and Vern collaborated on that? Man.
I don't know where that program is now. It's in a box of slides somewhere. But we still have this narration that Vern put together. And I think it captures the kind
that.
Of image of Jesus that we want to project. Pardon me?
Don't ever lose that.
No, that's a very...
It was really interesting, David, that when you were reading the part about, you know, if you could choose any day to be with the Master, that part I remember so vividly. We were in Snowmass, and I when you put those beautiful slides and you showed the stoking of a fire... That was 30 years ago, David, 30 years ago, and I still remember it like it was yesterday. It was so thrilling to see that and to be able to, that marvelous job that you did of matching slides with the narration. Do you remember who did the narration? Was that Vern or was that Stephen Zent? Do you remember?
No, I think Vern did the narration on that recorded version. And you know, Eric, that image that you're talking about, that's on my must-have shot list. I want a fire burning on the shore of Sea of Galilee at dawn.
Ah, well, we'll definitely do that. And that's the other thing, Paula, is that we're going to be doing some things that that really no one else has ever done, because people will generally, if they're going to do a film crew, you generally shoot everything with Panavision or Aries or Aeroflex or whatever you're going to use. But that's normally what they do. They'll have a photographer who will just do some cover shots. The fact that David and I are going to marry the two elements, the photographs and the images, and it's all in high definition, and we're shooting it with what they call, and not to get too complicated, but what they call HD DSLRs, and normal, regular high-def, I use a big Panasonic video camera, too. So it's like we're going to be using all kinds of media, including recording narration. So we're going to be doing interviews, and David can talk to you about some of these things. I know you have some people on the line right now, but one of the things I'd love to come back with, David, is for you to talk about Sephoris.
Okay, well, we can do that, Paula. Do you think we ought to take some of our guests' questions or comments?
Let's do. One of the first questions, and I'm going to get to the callers here in just a second, was that somebody asked that they had heard that the Israeli government has shut down this kind of thing, Christian evangelism and that kind of thing. Do you think that might be a problem for you guys?
Well, we aren't really going over there to do evangelism. We're going over there to film and record, and I don't think that will impact us. We are in contact with a fellow who provides helicopter services for film crews, and he's not indicated that there would be any problem at all. We do have to go through special security clearance, of course, to be using a helicopter in Israel, but we don't foresee any real problems. Of course,
cool.
Things change from day to day and week to week also. So go ahead, Paula.
I'm going to take a call by Carol Hay, Carol Setter. Sorry, Carol. She would love to ask you guys about donating miles, and she has some logistical questions about how she can help with this project. And I know that there's probably going to be a lot of readers who would love to help with this project and would like to know what they can do. So let me see if I can get Carol on. Carol, are you there, darling?
Carol, are you there, darling?
Carol?
Carol?
Maybe, hold on, maybe Carol is on the other.
I'm on the phone. Can
Carol,
you
are you there?
I am here on the phone. Hey.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Carol.
Oh. Hey, David. Hey, Eric.
Hey, Carol. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm doing well. I'm glad to, David, that was really something that you just read. That was such a moving piece, and we're so fortunate to be able to read the Urantia book in a way that makes all of this information come to life. And I remember, you know, you mentioned my name is Carol Hay. I was married to John Hay for a while, and we went over to, on our honeymoon, years and years and years ago, we went over to Israel on our honeymoon with a group of Urantia book readers from Oklahoma, a bunch of older readers who were just the sweetest people. Our tour guide was amazed at how sweet everyone was. He'd never been with a bus full of people who were so polite and caring before in his life. He was just blown away. And one of the things I remember that will always stick in my mind is being in the old city of Jerusalem and watching this bus driver, who was this tall Israeli man with a shaved head, arguing with these little blue-haired Urantian Oklahoma ladies, and he was pointing down the common way that people went, that they thought Jesus went, on the way to the cross, and they were shaking their heads and pointing in the other direction. They wanted to go this way because that's how they went. And yeah. So it was, and you were in spirit with us on that trip, because everyone knew the study that you had done, and we wandered out into several fields looking for different things that were off the beaten path, and we had information from you at that time that made everything so much more compelling. We knew about stuff that we were looking at that wasn't in the common tour guide information because of the work that you had done. And it was so meaningful then, and to be able to now utilize technology and to be able to take video and to have all the things that are available that you and Eric are going to work on is going to make so much more of the teachings of the fourth part of the Urantia book come to life. And I am just on fire about this. I think it is just the most wonderful thing for you to be able to put together for generations to come. It's going to be great. So we've been looking, Paula, into I've only known about the Joshua Ben Joseph project for a couple of months, but I do know that David and Eric worked out a budget that involved having people donate miles from their Mileage Plus program. And that was a significant part of how they were planning to travel, to use other people's miles to get back and forth, not only to Israel, but also to manage the background and the production that's necessary for the project in the States. So I kind of looked into that. We've been looking into a way for all of us to donate miles to them. And it seems to me that unless we are an approved charity that is dealing with an urgent humanitarian effort, I don't think we're going to be able to qualify as a charity. So that means that we will be donating miles just as one person would to another, a family member or a friend, and that includes a surcharge on the miles. And the cost really adds up, perhaps so much that it might just be easier to pay cash for a ticket. But what that means is that we are all going to have to really think about how we can help with this project. David and Eric can possibly have an even steeper uphill climb to raise the funds that are needed, not only for their production costs, but it may be that we're going to have to pay cash for their travel. So I encourage everyone, before the end of the year, to go to the Joshua Ben Joseph website and donate to this project. You can get a tax deduction on your 2010 taxes by donating now, and then, you know, maybe next year when we've got a little extra money again, we can donate for 2011. But we've got 2 weeks left before the end of the year, so get to the joshuabenjoseph.com website, and there are two ways to donate, either online through PayPal or Visa using the PayPal through the Urantia University, and then also through the Boulder School. You can write a check, and that address is on the website. They are in need of funds to get this thing going. This is an opportunity for us to participate in a legacy project that's going to affect people for generations to come. It's just an amazing project, and this would be a wonderful Christmas present to honor anyone you know, either a longtime Urantia book reader or maybe a child of a Urantia book reader that you know, to dedicate a donation in their name as a Christmas present.
Carol, are miles deductible if people contribute miles?
Not unless it's to a charity. And the charities that are approved, they're pretty tight. It's humanitarian efforts or people who need life-saving surgery that need to get from one city to another. And we've looked into it, and I'm still trying to break through that, but it doesn't look like we're going to be able to. So it's not a tax deduction to donate miles.
Well, how about if people buy us a ticket? If we had, for example, we need to go down to Florida to university to do an interview. That's two round trips that we need. What if we had somebody who had enough miles to actually purchase a ticket for us, and they contributed the ticket to a 501c3, for example, Urantia University? Wouldn't they then qualify for a tax deduction on that?
They probably would, and I can tell you that it would be, if they would contact either the Urantia University, or I would be happy to try and facilitate the transaction on that. We would do our best to make sure that that would occur. So, yeah, if they want to, they can contact me, and I'm at cosmicbiker@gmail.com. And I am always willing to be contacted to try and help with this. So that's a great idea, David.
I really appreciate your help with it. We do need substantial funds to pursue this. We've already had enough come in to where we have kind of a base level. We know that we can begin the project. But depending on how much support and help we get, that will determine the quality and the amount of the work that we're able to actually create as a final product. So we're really asking for people's help to create these resources. It will be a community resource, as you pointed out, that will be valuable for a lot of people for a long period of time.
Absolutely.
Well, and David, I think you brought up something really important, and that is that you're going to do a lot of preliminary work on this project in the United States before you actually go to Israel, so maybe you can touch on that a little bit and what all that entails. And Carol, I invite you to just stay here with us as long as you want. So,
great.
Well, there's a lot of background research that needs to be done. I've done a number of projects here that have required research, and it seems like you're never finished. It's always a problem. You think you have a clear picture of what's going on, and you find another article in another journal, and it keeps expanding your picture. I think it's a problem with any kind of artwork. In my younger years, I did quite a bit of artwork, and I found that in painting or doing stained glass work, any kind of finished piece of artwork that you're trying to do, finding the stopping point is really, really critical, because it's easy to overwork things and keep struggling and struggling and struggling to express your vision, and then you just make a mess of it. So there's a challenge there to do the initial research, and I'm actively involved in doing that right now. In the past, I would say 2 to 3 decades, there has been such a tremendous amount of work done in archaeology and anthropology. The collapse of the Soviet Union was a real boon for scientists, because the Soviets had done a lot of research and a lot of work that was closed to Western scholars. So much has opened up here that is just remarkable. One of the most remarkable things in my mind here, and something that we're going to be working with as we do this production, has been the excavation of Sepphoris. this was begun in the 1980s. It turns out that Sepphoris, which was Herod Antipas's capital city, it's about 3 miles or so from Nazareth. Nazareth, essentially, in Jesus' day and age, was a bedroom community of the capital city of Galilee. And the capital city was this cosmopolitan, bustling city with Greeks and Jews and Romans and Syrians and people from all over the world. There's a big theater there. I mean, how many people think of Jesus sitting in a Roman theater watching a Greek play? It's completely out of their line of sight.
Yeah.
You know, they see this country peasant boy taking care of sheep out in the fields, and that's kind of the image they have of him. That's simply not the case. He was living right in the center of this area where the Roman political system and Greek philosophy and the struggles of the Jewish people with their temple state to keep their theology intact with the onslaught of Hellenization, all of this dynamic cosmopolitan city, Jesus was right in the middle of this. This is where he lived and worked. This is where he formulated and began proclaiming his gospel of the kingdom. It's interesting that he left Sepphoris and didn't spend a lot of time there after he and Joseph started working there, and we're not quite sure what was going on there. The Urantia book says for this and other reasons, Jesus stayed away from there. I suspect that part of it had to do with Herod's political rule. I think that Jesus understood you had to be careful what you said and how you said it and who you said it to, and it probably wasn't the safest place for him to be proclaiming his gospel. Anyway, that's just one example of the kind of things that current studies have brought to light. The ruins of Caesarea there on the coast have been excavated over the past 30 years or so. The ruins at Skyphopolis have been excavated. These are wonderful, wonderful places, and there's a lot we can learn by studying them and by learning more about the daily context in which Jesus lived his life and taught.
Yeah, David, tell them about the Jordan River, how this may be one of the last chances to actually film parts of the Jordan River.
Well, yes, there are problems there with the water in Israel, and you know, much of the Jordan River is being diverted for irrigation and agriculture. There are times of year when it just turns into a little trickle, and we want to get as much as we can today. Israel is changing rapidly. The geopolitical situation in the Middle East is so volatile. We don't know if your answer book readers will be able to travel there in the distant future. Just a generation ago, my friend Marvin Gowron, he freely traveled through Iraq and Afghanistan. This is just maybe 30, 35 years ago. Now you can't do that, and hopefully that's not going to happen with the rest of the Middle East, but we don't know. There's a little sense of getting over there and getting these images while the getting is good. If readers can go in the future, that'll be great. They should go. It's a pilgrimage that every reader, every lover of Jesus should undertake. But we want to go and get what we can while it's still there.
Yeah, David, to bring up a point that you just mentioned right now, and that is the vast majority of your Urantia book readers probably, unfortunately, will never have an opportunity to go to the places that you and I are going to go to. And that's one of the reasons that we want to put this together with images, with movies, with motion, with photographs, with narration, so that we can bring that back here to the readers.
Eric, do you have any absolutely have-to-get shots in mind besides this fire, beside the Sea of Galilee?
Yes, as of right now, there are 3,216 have-to-get shots.
I believe it.
You know, it's interesting because, David, you and I are both, in the arts. And, when it comes to shooting photographs and shooting video, One of the things that I, as a filmmaker, I constantly have to keep in mind is not to shoot what we call goat pasture. In other words, don't just shoot for the sake of shooting, because you'll never use it. It's just wasting your time. So that's one of the reasons why, you know, we're putting together these various shot lists. And that's another thing that could be really helpful for anyone else who can help get involved with this project, is if you have some concepts or ideas or locations that you feel would be really important, please send them to us. Just go to the Joshua Ben Joseph Project and give us some concepts or ideas of places that you really would love to see shot. And if we can do it, if we have the time to do it, we're going to do it.
And there is a link on the website where you can send in your suggestions. The URL for the website is joshuabenjoseph.org, and the words are separated with dashes. It's joshua-ben-joseph.org. And I wanted to just add something to what Eric was saying. In addition to photographing and filming these various sites, we're planning to visit a number of the major museums and photograph artifacts so that we can give people a better idea of what life was like on a daily basis in the times of Jesus. And I also should mention that we'll also be doing some filming in Jordan. We're planning on going to Israel in April, and then in October go to Jordan so that we can get the cities of the Decapolis, we can get the prison where John the Baptist was held, we can get that side of the river where Jesus was baptized. Pella is there, really important place. The village sometime known as Beit Adis we've located and are going to be doing some investigating there. It's where Jesus lived after his baptism in the hills there. And it's interesting, that whole area now is a nature preserve, so I'm hoping we can get some nice material from that. And outside of present-day Amman, which in Jesus' day was Philadelphia. There is what is touted as the oldest Christian church or gathering place, and it's dedicated to the ministry of the 70. There's a mosaic there and a dedication of this place to the 70. So we want to get some of that material also.
Wow. Well, it's just, just being there was one of the greatest things that I've ever experienced. And I'd love to share some personal stories about that, but we have a couple of callers that have been waiting for a while, so I'm going to take a couple more calls. I think this is Norman Ingram, so let's see. Norman, is this Norman? Somebody is calling on Skype, and the problem is that Skype, when you're calling on the computer, sometimes you get that echo, and it's just really intense. We'll try another one here. Hold on. Area code 202, you're on the Cosmic Citizen. 202? Area code 202?
Hello?
Hello?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, Paula.
Is this George?
Yes, it is.
Hi, George. George Gordon, did you have some comments for David and Eric?
I just came on, so I haven't heard anything yet, so I'll just listen for a little bit, and then I'll talk later.
Okay. Thank you, dear.
Bye-bye.
Okay, so what I wanted to share with you guys, and just to give an example of you know, how beautiful it is to go to these places, and I want to say armed with the Urantia book, because the richness and the detail of the story is so incredibly beautiful. And a couple of experiences I had, David, when we were there, I was particularly enthralled with Galilee, and I just posted a quote on the board. I'd like to read it. It's from paper 182 in Gethsemane, when Jesus was alone in Gethsemane. It says, Jesus' humanity was not insensible to the situation of private loneliness, public shame, and the appearance of the failure of his cause.
all these sentiments bore down on him with indescribable heaviness. In this great sorrow, his mind went back to the days of his childhood in Nazareth and to his early work in Galilee. At the time of this great trial, there came up in his mind many of those pleasant scenes of his earthly ministry. It was from these old memories of Nazareth, Capernaum, Mount Hermon, and of the sunrise and sunset on the shimmering Sea of Galilee that he soothed himself as he made his human heart strong and ready to encounter the traitor who would so soon betray him. When the first night we were in Galilee, a bunch of us went swimming in the sea. It is an exquisitely beautiful place. I know the three of you, Carol and David and Eric, you've all been there. It is exquisitely beautiful. And we had gone down from the kibbutz, and it was dusk, and we all swam out into the Sea of Galilee. And I had the most incredible deja vu. I had two deja vus while I was there that were like I tapped into a memory that Jesus had. That's the only way I can describe it. Swam out about yards from the shore, and I turned around and I looked back, and the sun was going down over the mountains. And the sky was a beautiful pinkish hue, and these strips of purplish clouds hung, you know, just above the mountains, and the water in the sea was so soft, and it was lapping against my skin, and the sea was glistening in the last bit of sunlight, and I realized Jesus did this. He saw this. He looked out and saw this scene exactly like this. He swam in the sea. He felt the softness of this water on his skin. It was so powerful. And then the other one was while we were there at the Galilee, we all gathered there on the shore. And behind us, there were some children playing on pebble. You know, there's a pebbly beach, and they were playing on the beach. And we were all gathered there in our little lawn chairs and whatever. And our good friend Steve McIntosh was reading parables by the sea. And I had the same sense, the same feeling. Wow, Jesus, this robust young man, you know, here was Steve McIntosh, a robust young man, and he was reading Jesus' parables there by the Sea of Galilee. And here we were, you know, all lovers of Jesus, all hanging on every word that Jesus said as Steve read these words and repeated them in the parables. And in the background, children were playing, and I thought, wow, that this happened. The apostles sat here with their wives, and their children played in the background while Jesus read these words, or said these very words, while he taught these very words. And it was just the most powerful deja vu. And those experiences, you know, if you can recreate that for people with your visuals, with, you know, what you're bringing to us, those of us who will never be able to go there and experience that for ourselves, it's such a gift. It's such a gift.
Well, you know, Paula, it's interesting to be on the planet so shortly after the time of Michael's bestowal that artifacts are still present. One of the ones that comes to mind is the lintel at the synagogue at Capernaum. The reconstructed synagogue that's there now is, you know, was put back together after an earthquake after Jesus' time. It's not the same one, but it's built apparently on the same foundation, and they used some of the same materials to reconstruct it. Remember in the Urantia book, I don't have the quote here in front of me, Jesus, I think it was during the epical sermon, he pointed to the lintel and referred to some images that were on there, a grape cluster and a pot of manna, and the book specifically mentions this. Well, that lintel is there. You can see it. It's been put up with the reconstruction, except it's been put up backwards. The images that he pointed to are pointing to the outside of the building rather than the inside. And it's just little things like that that they stimulate insights, and they're just sweet. I earlier mentioned the idea of a pilgrimage, and it really is a pilgrimage. again, you're going to the place where Michael did his final bestowal. And you're up there in Galilee, and you look up and you see Mount Hermon stretching up above the horizon with its snowy top, and you understand that this is the place where the sovereign of our universe actually attained his sovereignty. It's a remarkable experience to be there, to go and see these things. And you can consider that you're taking your thought adjuster and your seraphim on a tour of the planet. Imagine, they're stuck with you wherever you are, and they probably like getting out and seeing some of these things too. So if nothing else, take your thought adjuster on a tour.
Go ahead, Eric.
Okay, I was just going to just say that that's, again, one of the visualizations. It's so difficult because we're not going to have that much time. I mean, if you exclude travel and stuff, we're going to probably have 8.5 days there. And so we have to cover a lot of territory, and we have to be able to do these things on a very, very tight schedule. So, for instance, just to go to Mount Hermon would take over a day. And so we're going to be doing a lot of stuff visually with technology. I have these super fast, long lenses, like 640-millimeter lenses, to be able to zoom in on certain places. So our whole concept is to be able to make it so real to people when they see this in high definition, that rather than thinking that, hey, yeah, this is another thing from the Discovery Channel or from the History Channel that is done by so-called scholars, and not to put them down for this, but what is more important, the message or the messenger? If the messenger is very articulate and great, he could be expounding all these wonderful things, but they could all be false. So, the fact that we're going there with a book in hand, if not physically, at least on our computers, and be able to spot these places and to be able to show what they look like, and so people can actually visualize it for the first time. They can visualize it for the very first time, what it's really like. And we're going to do that with narration. We're going to do it with music. We're going to do it with scripting. We're going to do it with storylines and storyboards, documentary. So we're going to have enough material after we shoot this that it could take us years to be able to put all of these things together because we'll have so much.
Paul, it's very interesting. When I read a quote earlier in the program, the time is ripe to witness the figurative resurrection of the human Jesus from his burial tomb amidst the theological traditions and religious dogmas of 19 centuries. That's really an interesting quote. The current issue of Christianity Today, which is kind of a flagship evangelical publication, one of the lead articles is Jesus versus Paul. And the author notes that evangelical Christianity today is facing a crisis about the relationship between Jesus and Paul, that it's understood that Jesus preached the kingdom and Paul taught us all these other things. According to this author, that crisis is really hitting some of the evangelical seminaries right now, where the students are becoming far more interested in discovering what Jesus was talking about with the kingdom. And I just think that's a very interesting development at this period of time. And we've got this quote from the book that says, the time is ripe. It seems so important to me that we identify these trends in the culture and see where we can put the Urantia book, where it can be inserted into the culture, where it will have maximum impact. And if you've got trends like this happening, if we can somehow figure out how to get the Urantia book's message integrated into those areas where those trends are occurring, that we would see this thing disseminated much more effectively and much more quickly in this troubled world.
Boy, amen.
Oh, it's so true.
Go ahead,
Carol.
Paul.
Go ahead. I know you.
Paul Ray, as you remember, I think it was in the 90s, created a new idea of what an emerging cultural group was called the Cultural Creatives. And one of the things that I thought was very interesting in his book was that he said that the spiritual aspect of the cultural creatives were looking for a new story, that was a very prevalent hunger that they had identified in this emerging group of society. And we can't just have the story when we have so much that we are now capable of accessing for every other kind of information. We've got amazing video, you know, like Eric was talking about, the Discovery Channel, the kind of information that we all have available to us that we can access easily is at a different level than it's ever been before, and we really need to address that as Urantians and be responsible for bringing information to this very spiritually hungry cultural group that has emerged on the planet, not just in story form and not just in book form, but also to say, well, I back up on that. It's not a book. It's a revelation. And we all know that the writing and the information that's involved there is unlike any other writing that we've ever experienced before. But to be able to take the aspect of the visual and audio technology that's available to us and bring this into a light that we've never had before is something that's really a responsibility that we have as Urantia book readers.
Boy, that's very good, Carol. Carol, that's wonderful, and I just think it makes so much sense for us to be able to do things like this where we can give people maybe a truer picture, because I think that, I mean, I look at things so visually, you know, and so thank God I am in the field I'm in. I'm a very visual person. As an example, and this is kind of funny, but back in the middle 60s, or like 65, I went to Italy for the first. I was with a group back then. I went to Italy, and it was so amazing because I thought Italy was black and white. I really and truly only saw Italy from war pictures from back in the 40s and stuff like that, where everything was black and white. And I was amazed how beautiful Italy really was. It was just breathtaking with its colors. But if you have never seen colors like that before, then your concept of what it's really like is very dimmed. And so I think that that's another thing that David and I are going to really be able to do is to bring visual concepts of the footprints that Jesus walked in. So that what did he see with his eyes, like Paula talked about on the Sea of Galilee? What did Jesus see? And so you could almost do a whole documentary without ever showing a picture of the person, for instance, to try to replicate Jesus. You could do it all with images from his eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So you wouldn't need an actor. It would all
visual.
Be done visually.
Eric?
Yes.
It's visual context, too, Eric. It's visual context, which is so important, because when you have visual context, which, you know, David, you made a comment earlier about how all these centuries, and maybe it was in the thing you read about the Galilean, all of these centuries, for 2,000 years, he has been the primary figure and even the primary purpose for art. And it's been these artists who have created his life in visual context has given us, you know, that especially the unlearned, those who couldn't read or those who were, you know, I mean, how many people even had access to scriptures for thousands of years? They didn't. But they had these artistic recreations which gave them visual context. And so I really think that is important, too, as you read the stories and then you have the context, like the maps you created, David, that show, okay, this is how far they walked when they went from here to there that day. And it really gives you a concept also of, wow, that was quite a walk. But that's how they got around.
Well, yeah, Paula, it's interesting that you mentioned that also in the light of Carol's earlier comment about how the technology makes it possible for us to do so much more than just present information. You know, the picture of Jesus, the image of Jesus that's in the mind of the average person, I would venture to say, is derived from the stories in the New Testament and from Renaissance art. And that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got an opportunity here to use the arts, to use the technology, to really expand that image. One of the things we haven't mentioned that's on our list and that's at a pretty high level on the list is doing some interviews. We want to interview people who are involved in archaeology and history, museum curators, a number of other people working in a number of other areas, so that we can get a wider range of views on the period of time in which Jesus was living and teaching than we could just derive by ourselves. So getting those interviews down will be an important part of this too. And our hope is that when we produce a finished DVD, the DVD could have a documentary on it and also have some extra materials, perhaps the full length of interviews that are only where we only take sound bites when we do the actual production, but readers would have an opportunity to listen to in-depth interviews with people who are leaders in areas, cutting-edge areas where new research is revealing more and more about this story.
Wonderful. And, you know, I want to bring up, too, hold this question in your mind about some of the more visually compelling subjects you plan to capture there in the Holy Land. I wanted to bring up, because Carol had mentioned the cultural creatives and that they are emerging, and there is another very important group that's emerging, and they actually call themselves the Emergent Christians. We've had them on our show before. We've had top members of this movement. You can't even call it an organization. It's a true movement. The top leaders of this movement have come on our show and interviews with us. Phyllis Tickle and Philip Gully, and they are leading the way with this movement of emergent Christians who are grappling with these very issues that you've described, David, the issues between Paul and traditional theology and the religion of Jesus as opposed to the religion about him. And I just wanted to share a quote from the Arantia book again about this very topic of Christianity and how an of Jesus will emerge. It's from Paper 170, Section 5, Later Ideas of the Kingdom. The authors of the book tell us this. They say, "Mistake not. There is in the teachings of Jesus an eternal nature which will not permit them forever to remain unfruitful in the hearts of thinking men. The kingdom as Jesus conceived it has to a large extent failed on earth. For the time being, an outward church has taken its place. But you should comprehend that this church is only the larval stage of the thwarted spiritual kingdom, which will carry it through this material age and over into a more spiritual dispensation where the Master's teachings will enjoy a fuller opportunity for development. Thus, does the so-called Christian church become the cocoon in which the kingdom of Jesus' concept now slumbers. The kingdom of the divine brotherhood is still alive and will eventually and certainly come forth from this long submergence. Just as surely as the butterfly will eventually emerge as the beautiful unfolding of its less attractive creature of metamorphic development." So I just love that because it actually talks about the butterfly emerging. And, Carol, you mentioned that word emerge, the cultural creatives emerging, the emergent Christians. I just love the fact they use that word because, you know, it tells me that they're right on. They are emerging, and we should expect it. We should watch for it because it will happen. The teachings of Jesus will not fail. They cannot fail. It's not possible for them to fail. So,
the concept of emergence is really important there, I think, Paula. You know, we look at the Urantia book's discussion of the unfolding of the supreme, and we understand that in the evolutionary process there are directions, there are currents, there are goals, and that the process is moving towards those goals. And we, as readers of the Urantia book who want to see this book disseminated in our world, should be looking for those emergent realities that could be used to, that can be fostered. I think this is the way that our spiritual benefactors help us with our daily lives. They foster and support and encourage those things we're doing that are leading us in the right direction. And we need to be learning to do that on a cultural level. So many over the years in the Urantia movement, I've seen so many people who seem to be more interested in defending their own theological and cultural turf rather than taking a look at what the Urantia book says needs to be done. Eric mentioned earlier about his initial problems with Part 4. I had the same reaction. I grew up in a really conservative, fundamentalist Christian home, and even as a child, I thought 90% of the theology I was hearing was just nonsense. It just didn't make any sense. I was so disgusted with Christianity, I didn't want to have a thing to do with it as I was, when I left home. And then I found the Urantia book, and it took me a while to come to terms with what Christianity was. I had to learn to see it in a different perspective. And now I understand it as it's the cocoon. It's where we need to be. It's where we need to be focusing some energy. There's a global infrastructure in place that can carry this message of the fifth epical revelation. Just as in Jesus' time, there was an infrastructure in place of synagogues and Jewish communities throughout the Roman Empire that served as the conduit through which that gospel. Was distributed, through which ideas were passed. So I think it's important that we look at that and work with that as best we can. You know, if you want to build a fire, everyone says, well, the Urantia book is for the whole world. It's for everybody. It's not just for Christians. That's true. Jesus' bestowal was for everybody, for the whole world. But he found a context in which to implant it. He didn't even start his own religion. He built upon the work of John the Baptist. John started this whole thing of the kingdom, and Jesus went with it. And I think we're in that same situation today. We've got to find the fertile areas where there is a relationship between the ideas of the Urantia book and begin working in those areas. If you want to build a fire, you don't start with the biggest logs. You start with some small ones. You need some kindling. You got to get the fire going before you can ignite those big logs. And our entire readership community is challenged with dealing with these realities.
You know, that's amazing, David, because one of the thoughts that, and I think I had told you about this, that exactly the way you're talking about it, starting with kindling. In my family, in my brother and sisters, very fundamental. So they totally don't look at the Urantia papers at all, because they look at it as a cult, and it was my fault, obviously, because within the first few hours of getting the Urantia papers, I managed to turn off half of Denver. And also sent my thought adjuster into a nervous breakdown. He actually had a nervous breakdown. So, I think what we have to do is look at conceptually, like we're talking about, how can we talk to someone who say, let's say that it's a theologian, and here's an example. If you talk to a theologian and say, you know what, the only problem I'm having right now is that Jesus denied his Father in heaven. I'm sorry, I can't get that straight in my brain. Could you help me with this? What do you think he meant when he was saying that? Do you think that he actually denied his Father in heaven? And so, they're going to have this puzzled look on their face because they're going to say, well, it's in the Bible. And I'll say, well, it actually isn't in the Bible. What you're taking is a part of the Psalms that were here long before Jesus came. So read the Psalms, read the 22nd Psalm and things like that, and you're going to find that someone actually overheard him mumbling as the Psalms, which he loved, as he was on the cross. And it's amazing because all of a sudden you get that person saying, wow, that's a possibility. I never thought of that. Boy, thank you. That helps me out. Well, why can't we do the same thing with a Muslim? Why can't we do the same thing with a Jew? Why can't we do the same thing with an agnostic? And instead of trying to shove something down someone's throat, we do it through photograph, through video, through these beautiful images, and with text to be able to say, hey, here's a concept. What do you think of this? So So these are just some of the things that David and I are going to be doing on our journey.
So getting back to that question then that someone on the board asked earlier, what kind of individuals do you hope to kind of highlight while you're there? Are you going to be photographing locals and some of the local culture and that kind of thing?
Pretty much everything. I'm going to let David handle this one.
Well,
okay.
I would answer yes. Eric and I have had several extensive meetings, planning meetings, and I've got more coming up here, particularly with putting together a shot list. And the shot list is critical because, as Eric pointed out, you know, we've got limited time, so we need to go and get what we're going to get. But, you know, Israel today, I think, is very much like it was in Jesus' time. And I think we can get contemporary pictures that will communicate some of that. The difference is really palpable between Jerusalem and Galilee. And the quote that you read earlier, Paula, really, really points that out. Jerusalem is this bustling city with all of this religious conflict and a lot of religious nonsense and illusion, but it's just this dynamic center. I mean, there's a strong military presence there, just as there was in Jesus' day. It's not uncommon to walk down the street and see young people walking around with AK-47s. I mean, in many ways, it's like it was in Jesus' time. Galilee is this tropical paradise. It's just a beautiful place, a beautiful countryside, and it's so pleasant to see that Jesus appreciated nature and enjoyed the beauty of Galilee. Those contrasts are still there. Nazareth is this bustling, dirty, noisy town that I think is probably very much like Nazareth was in Jesus' day on a larger scale. Just, you know, the Camelot. Think of the Camelot that was there and the implications of that with these crusty caravan drivers and just, you know, what was going on in that day and time. So I think that in addition to getting some of these historic sites and artifacts, that we're going to be able to capture the spirit of these stories using some shots of contemporary reality. Just the bustling crowds in Nazareth, I think, will resonate in people's minds with the crowds in Nazareth at the time Jesus was there.
Yeah, we want to do, like David said, there's a whole bunch of things that we're looking for already. We want to find someone at a potter's wheel so that then we can think about Jacob when they talk about Jacob. And wells and stuff, you know, like Jacob's well and things. Any of these visualizations where we can get, instead of it just being so commercialized that you look at it and you say, that's just plastic. That doesn't do a thing for my heart at all. But visually, it's a postcard, exactly. And what we want to do is make it so strong. You know, they talk about if a picture paints 1,000 words, then, you know, then what would a movie be? It would be a library, all right? So that's our whole thing. Our whole concept is to be getting all of these images and to go along with these words. And it can just be, it's an incredible task, and we just can't wait to get started on it. And obviously, as Carol mentioned and everyone else, we definitely need some help on this. It's a huge project, and it would be great if David and I were just independently wealthy. We just say, hey, you know what, I won the lottery, and we'll just fly over there on my private jet, and we'll be there. But we can't do that, and
this is
necessary.
What were you saying, Carol?
That's because this is Urantia. Nothing's easy here.
Yes, exactly.
And my fear is, I remember Larry Mullins once said this, my only fear is I'm going to get to the Mansion Worlds and somebody's going to say to me, Larry, you were so good at rowing that slave ship. We've got this really big slave ship over here that we know you're going to be really good at rowing.
I love that, Carol. That is so cool.
I think we're all going to get to the mansion worlds and have a similar experience in that we're going to see areas where we could have done so much more. You know, it's going to, I imagine that the experience will be such, when we see this planet in the context of the Marantia world perspective, which we can only fantasize about now, it's just going to be an oh my gosh kind of experience that will stay with us forever, of helping us to take advantage of the service opportunities that are in critical situations in which we find ourselves. From a universe perspective, I don't think we appreciate the critical situations that we are in right now.
Well, and sometimes those situations are so painful, you know, that we get lost in the pain and forget that it's really a great teaching opportunity now. And, you know, life goes along fine and out of the, you know, nothing out of the ordinary happens, and then, boom, something out of the ordinary happens, and it becomes a great opportunity to be an example.
Yes, yeah.
I see exactly. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to mention, I just thought something just came to mind that is a perfect example of where this project is going to take us beyond where we currently are with the understanding of the life of Jesus. I, like a lot of people who are listening in and what David and Eric said, I grew up also in a fundamentalist Christian family, and one of the songs that we learned in Sunday school was Zacchaeus. And Zacchaeus was a wee little man, and a wee little man was he, climbed up in a sycamore tree for the Lord he wanted to see. And, you know, it was really fun because all the kids got to point their fingers and in a loud voice say, Zacchaeus, you come down. And it was a very popular song. Well, that's all I had. I just knew that there was this little guy who climbed up into a sycamore tree to see Jesus, and that Jesus told him to get out of the tree because he was going to his house. So I then read the story in the Urantia book, and I then saw the place, and this is something that David and Eric are going to be able to communicate through their video. I saw the road that Jesus and his apostles would have walked on that would have taken them through, is it Jericho, right? Okay, so you have to go through Jericho, and then you take a right, and you go up the hill on your way to Jerusalem, which is where also Jesus saw or met Lazarus and his two sisters. But that's like, I mean, you know, we could just go on and on about all the different places that there is meaning from the Urantia book and also from a visual perspective of what's happening. But just to know, when I was in Jericho and I could look around and I could see, okay, Jesus came towards the town, so probably people who were walking away from the town going north probably were walking away, and suddenly they said, oh my gosh, there's Joshua ben Joseph and his apostles, and they turned and ran back into town to tell everyone that they were coming. So that was something that I got from understanding the visual aspect of how Jesus would have entered the town. And then what the Urantia book had to give me was I found out that Zacchaeus was a tax collector, and he was a smaller man, and he used that role as tax collector as an adult to probably get back at all the people who had bullied him when he was younger. And he had taken that position of power and had used it to do something he could never do as a younger man, but he was still short. So by now, all the people in the town understand that Jesus is coming. He's walking towards the town. So they all run out to the road to watch him pass. And Zacchaeus, being short, can't see over the crowd, so he gets up in the tree. All of this sort of thing, I mean, you know, you can go on through everything that happened through the Urantia book story, but having that story and understanding the visual aspect of where the town was in relation to where Jesus would have been traveling gave me something that it's 1,000 times richer than what I had as a little girl when I sang that song. It took it from just being a little sing-song story into this unbelievable human story that was a perfect example of who Jesus was and how he affected people and how he still affects them today.
And that's exactly what we're hoping to accomplish with some of the materials that we generate.
You know, Carol, I remember, I'm just going to bring up this quick little point, but some years ago when we went to, it was at St. Hyacinth, and I don't remember how many years ago that was, but you and Joan Mullins sang in that Catholic church. You remember that, Carol?
Yes, I do.
Well, it was so incredible because, as I remember, there weren't very many people in there, and the two of you just a cappella just did a chant. And it was so breathtaking, and it just filled that church with this music. No one said, wow, are you guys Catholic, or are you guys French, or are you guys Christians, or are you guys Jews? Who cared what you were and where we were? It was the beauty of that. And that's one of the concepts that we want to bring with the video and with the photography and with everything else. We're going to make this into to this visualization of the Urantia Papers, particularly part four.
Yeah. Well, and here's another
Go ahead, Paula.
Well, it's another example of what Carol is saying, where Jesus encountered the blind man on the Sabbath day, and he spat on the ground and mixed some clay with spittle and, you know, gave the blind man, you know, put it on his eyes and instructed him to go, you know, on a journey. You know, here's this blind man. He's supposed to go to the Pool of Siloam and, you know, and then his sight will be restored. And I would love to see you just kind of cover what that journey was, because it was no easy thing for a blind man to do this.
And
it's a good example. When you put that in context, you know, it becomes very intriguing and interesting.
That, Paula, this brings up another point. We talked about it briefly before, and that is when David and I decided to put this together, it was never on the thought that it's us, that it's just the two of us against the world. It was merely that we were going to initiate something. We were going to be the catalyst to get this thing moving. And it's going to be so important for the Urantia community to get behind us on ideas, any thoughts that they have. I mean, it's not that we can use every single one, but anything that people can suggest, something that stands out very strongly visually in their mind that they would love to be able to see. Just like you mentioned, Paula, about, well, how far away was the pool of Siloam? How, you know, what distance did he have to walk? All of these things are going to be very, very helpful to David and I as we put together our final shot list.
That's really important, Eric. I appreciate you mentioning that. And in addition to that, if people have ideas for materials they would like to use in their own dissemination efforts, tell us about those as well.
Place on your site where they can submit some of that?
Yes. If they go to the Joshua Ben Joseph website, it's joshua-ben-joseph.org, and click on how you can participate. And it'll take you to a page where you can make donations and where there's a link where you can send in suggestions. And the suggestions are important. We're really looking forward to getting some of those. I wanted to just convey a little story. If you, you know, you spend time in this area, you end up with some stories. You meet interesting people. I climbed up the hill in Nazareth there, up this hilltop. I mean, it's an obvious place. There's only one big hilltop like the one they describe in the book. And I was so tickled to get to the top and find that there was a Salesian monastery there. The Salesians take in orphans, and the top of the hill was a playground for these young children. And I thought, what a fitting memorial to Jesus' bestowal of all these children running around playing in these trees in this grassy hilltop. And I was out in the parking lot of the monastery there, and looking out in the directions the Urantia book says Jesus used to look out in, and I was just kind of overcome with emotion, and I had tears in my eyes, and a nun came up to me and grabbed my hand, and she looked at me and she said, "Don't you just know that our master came up here to play when he was a young boy?" And it was just one of those moments in life, you know, where people are having insights and understandings that are not in the literature, not in the tradition, but you see something, and suddenly things begin to click into place, and you get a much bigger concept of what was really going on.
Well, and I have a story that, you know, it's similar to that that I want to share. When we were there, we had the most wonderful tour guide. He was an Arab Christian. He was a biblical scholar. He was the kind of guy that would say, you know, scholars typically believe this, but I say, you know, and he held us totally captivated with his stories as we would go from place to place. Well, one day we were going to Caesarea Philippi, which is where the headwaters of the Jordan are. And we read that part of the book about it and the beautiful description of this place. And he came back on the intercom on the bus and he said, you know, that is the most beautiful description of this place we're going that I have ever heard. He said, what does your book say about why Jesus took the apostles through there and then up on Mount Hermon, where he did his classic sermon about who do men say that I am? And we said, well, it just says that he did it, but there's no reason why. He said, well, I have a theory about that, and when we get up there, I'll tell you what my theory is. So we were all very curious about it. And so we went to Caesarea Philippi, and we saw the headwaters of the Jordan and a big rock wall with these niches carved out of it. And he explained to us that all the statues of the Roman gods were in these niches at one point, carved out of this sheer rock face. And then we went on up onto Mount Hermon, where the master sat with the apostles, and he said his made his comment, who do men say that I am? And Peter said, you know, some say you're crazy, some say you're beside yourself, some say you're a prophet. And Jesus said, but who do you say I am? And Peter stood up and said, you're the Son of the living God. And Anis, that was the name of our tour, he was our tour guide, he was explaining this to us, and he recounted this story where Peter stood up and said, you're the Son of the living God. And he said, you see, I believe that Jesus took them through this place as a parable, as a living parable. They first saw the niches with all the gods of stone, and then he took them up and he asked them this question, and Peter said, you're the Son of the living God. And Jesus responded, no man has told you that. God, the God in your heart told you that, revealed that to you. My Father has revealed that to you. And he said, you see, I believe Jesus did that because he wanted to show them the difference between the dead gods of stone and the living God. And just all at once, we had that exact reaction, Carol. We went, oh, wow, that's so beautiful. Because the living God sends a living Son to touch people where they live and breathe. And it was just so deeply moving, and here from an Arab Christian. And you know, we gave him the book, and he was so grateful. And when we finally got to Jerusalem, he got very ill, and he was so saddened of heart because he loved our group so much and he couldn't go on with us. And we all gathered around him and put our hands on him and prayed that he would be well, because we wanted him to come back the next day and be with us for our tours through. And the next day he showed up bright and early, and I'll never forget, he said to all of us, my medical workers! And he was complete. You know, the whole tour with us, he had a gout or something, and his ankles swelled all up, and he was really in bad shape the day before. After we prayed with him and for him, he miraculously got better. It was just a wonderful, wonderful adventure. And I know you guys, you know, as you go over, part of the beautiful thing about your going there is I want to hear all of the wonderful encounters that you will be sure to have. I know you will. I know you will encounter just what you said, David, like the nun. So you'll have so many like that, and that's part of the treasure. And I hope that you catch some of those on film. I mean, I think it would be so rich, you know.
Well, we're going to attempt to do that.
Yeah.
We've got a much longer list of things. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I was just going to say, if there's anyone that has any questions that they feel need to be answered or would like answered or whatever, or any suggestions and stuff. If anyone that's on the line right now, it would be kind of cool.
Okay, well, let me see. We have a few people. I think they were listening. We know that George Gordon was, but we'll put George back on and see. And then there's another one here, 970. 970, are you with us on Blog Talk? Area code 970? So some people just like to listen. Let's see if George, are you still with us, my friend?
Yes, I'm here.
Do you have any comments for these guys?
Sure. I find it fascinating. This morning I got up at about 4 o'clock, get into my meditative state, and I start to play that last paper in your answer book about the faith of Jesus. And I find it very uncanny that you are talking about something similar today when I was listening to the paper. Inspiration came over me that religion, as it is right now on this planet, is like watching a game of soccer. You watch the game because you are rooting for a team. Very few people on this planet are able to watch a soccer game and root for the game itself, no matter who wins. Mm-hmm. And so it is with religion as it is right now. Everyone is in some corner supporting a particular style of belief, a particular philosophy of religion. It is very difficult for you to break away from the emotional connection that you have with what you believe and more or less connect to the principle itself. That is why people end up going to churches. They change religion, they change churches, because they are not connecting to that divine spark which would let you transcend any particular style of belief. Even within the Urantia movement, people have different hang-ups on what is or what isn't, what should be accepted, what should not. And it's just that's where we are right now in our development and evolution. We shouldn't look down so much on people who are still struggling to come to the realization that religion, the religion of Jesus, is different and distinct from what is called Christianity. They just are evolving to where we are right now, where we can look at the religion of even midway creatures, the religion of Melchizedek, the religion of life carriers, the religion of celestial beings, the religion of entities even like divine counselors, and our expanded view. We are happy that we can be enlightened to the stage where we can express this religion that we have as a spiritual experience with God himself, as what Jesus had as a personal experience when he was here on the planet. But people are still not yet delivered from rooting for a particular team, a team of religion, so to speak. That's my comment. Thank you all for allowing me a chance to talk.
Well, thank you, George, and I think you bring up a really good point. I love that analogy. You know, we compete, and what we should do is cooperate. I think if we get to that mode where we're cooperating, we will find together what we can all root for. So, David and Eric, did you guys want to make a comment to that? And there's also a suggestion on the board for that somebody wants you guys to comment on something too, but I'll let you respond to George if you like.
I don't have any direct response. I just appreciate his observation. And, if we're going to make something that really is appealing to all religions, and I made some comments earlier about Christianity, and I feel strongly that Christianity is a starting point that we need to pay attention to. But I think the real challenge in internationalizing the revelation, getting away from specific churches and getting people more into their individual spiritual growth, is working with Jesus' concept of the kingdom. That's what his life was devoted to proclaiming was this gospel of the kingdom. And I think that one of the frontiers for dissemination that has yet to be developed is for readers of the Urantia book in a scholarly way to explore the world's religions, find where do some embryonic ideas of the kingdom exist in Islam? Where do they exist in Judaism? Where do they exist in Buddhism or Hinduism? And again, this is an idea of finding the embers of truth and getting them some oxygen from the revelation so that they can grow and become much more vital. But this, I think, is a challenge for future readers of the book to do this scholarship, find these references to what might be the kingdom, and to study the Urantia book well enough so that you really understand the nature of this kingdom and can work with these concepts from the other sacred books.
Yeah, very much so. And George, I think you know, as David said, you brought up some very, very good points. And this is that so many times I think we end up indoctrinating people, whether you call it an enculturation or whatever. We indoctrinate people against religion or against God or against Jesus by the mannerisms or by the dictatorial pressure that we put on them, and we say, you've got to believe this or you're not going to heaven or you're this and that. And so I think, George, that your point is very, very well taken, and that is we have to find a way to deliver truth. That's what Jesus did. Jesus didn't go out there. Yes, he quoted scripture. He quoted scripture when he was in Jerusalem and places, but most of the time people felt when they were walking with him that he wasn't giving them theology or dogma. He was giving them truth. He was feeding them grains of truth. And I think that that's another thing that this is another way, like David talked about, maybe we can stop some of the isms even within our own movement if we can actually show more of what actually took place, these visualizations and stuff, to let the thought adjuster take over. Let the thought adjuster do its work, and we can just sort of like put out some grains out there, and hopefully people will ask questions and want to know some answers. Is there life after death? Where do we go when we die? Are angels real? Who was Jesus? Why are we here? Where are we going? These are questions that burn in every person's soul, regardless of what belief system or non-belief system that they have. And I think that that's where one of the things that we can do, just like music. It's, you know, photographs and movies are very much like music. You can transform people visually, and that's what we're hoping to be able to do.
Wonderful. And we don't have much time left. I know it flies by. It sure does. We have 15 minutes left. Here's what the person on the board asked David. She said, I'd like to hear David discuss his understandings of the ruins that are in Capernaum that he believes might be connected to the life of Jesus that have not been acknowledged as such with the current historic understanding of the area.
That's a good question, and that question applies to a lot of different sites. It's a problem. 2,000 years have passed since the times of Jesus. The whole area in which he did his bestowal lies on a major fault line, and there have been huge earthquakes in that area. Springs have come and gone. Streams have changed their courses. There have been landslides. Ruins have been knocked down. It's amazing to look at the ruins of Beth Shem, of Scythopolis, that have been excavated. This was a beautiful Greek city, and it was pretty much destroyed in an earthquake. And when they excavated it, they left the ruins as they were in place after the earthquake. So you see these huge columns that crashed onto the stone streets and broke, and they left it all there that way. The same thing happened in Capernaum. The synagogue where Jesus taught was destroyed in an earthquake. It's thought that the reconstruction that's there now used some of the same materials and is built on the same foundation. The foundation has been dated back to Jesus' time on the basis of coins that were found there. One of the problems of some of these popular sites, particularly ones that are mentioned in the Bible, is that people make money by tourists coming to see them. I remember one time I was in Hebron, and this guy approached me in the street and wanted me to pay him to take me out and show me Abraham's oak tree, you know, as if Abraham had grown an oak tree that was still living in the 20th century. And there are things like that everywhere, particularly in Jerusalem. People are making money by showing you some site that corresponds somehow to a story in the Bible, but making sure that you really are seeing the actual place is a whole different set of problems. I mean, the Romans pretty much leveled Jerusalem in 70 AD. They tied huge beams to the back of teams of oxen and just dragged them through and knocked down as much of the city as they could. So most of what's there now has been reconstructed, and some of the sites are valid. Some of them are highly suspicious. As both Eric and Paul and Carol also have pointed out, the Urantia book pretty much pinpoints places, and you can get out there and find them. To get back to your question about Capernaum, same thing is true there. If you go to Capernaum, there's somebody who's going to show you Peter's house and things like that you know just can't be substantiated. I had a beautiful experience at Capernaum on one of my trips. I'd gone through the ruins there, appreciated the reconstruction of the synagogue, left Capernaum, walked down the seashore to where Bethsaida would have been and Zebedee's boat shop, and then I crossed the highway. There's a highway about a half a kilometer up the hill from the shoreline. And I walked up there and walked across the highway. There's just a big open field there, and I saw a stone sticking out of the ground that I knew wasn't a natural stone. And so I began clearing away some of the ground, and it was the old Roman road. And I thought, this is the road that Jesus and the apostles walked on, these flat stones that the Romans have put here. And so, you know, if you get out and look around, you can find things like that, and they're sweet, they're precious memories, and it's different from what the tourists and the tour guides are going to tell you has been going on there. It's really important to do your background research before you go to some place like this. I hope I addressed your question.
Yeah, I you know, the thing is, it's in everywhere you go over there, you know, and since the Israelis have gone back, they have undertaken excavating so much. And when we were on the tour bus, we would go by a hill, and Anise would say, "You see that hill there? That's what we call a tell." And what that tells us is that there are ruins under there. And it's just extraordinary what they have undertaken to excavate the cities of the Scythopolis, like the Decapolis, and cities like Scythopolis, where Jesus went with his father when he was 10 years old, and they sat in the amphitheater and watched the Roman games, and Jesus got so enthusiastic, and his father was cross with him. The only time in his whole life his father really got cross with him was because he got so into the game. And that's been excavated, and it's there now, and you can see that, I call it an amphitheater, but, you know, whether it was a coliseum or an amphitheater, but you can actually see it now. Sepphoris, David, that you mentioned earlier, 3 miles or something like that away from Galilee, and biblical scholars have said, why is this place not mentioned in the Bible when it was so close? We actually stood and looked at the governor's mansion, which the Urantia book says Jesus' father, Joseph, was killed when he fell from a scaffolding building that mansion. Jesus was 14. Now it's been excavated, and you can actually see it. So it's the richness of things like this, and that's actually a good idea, David. I hope you guys really cover that mansion and Sepphoris. I'm sure you will. there's just so much more to the story. And I think as we dig back into history and we look at that in the context of this incredible retelling of Jesus' life that's in the Urantia book, that will come alive. And I think Carol has expressed it, and I hope that I have too, our great enthusiasm for your efforts here, because I really can see all the possibilities. How long is this going to be, the documentary you guys are going to make?
There's multi-documentaries on this, Paula. So this is not just one. This is not just one visualization. We're going to be dealing with an awful lot of stock footage. We have storyboards that we'll be putting together for various documentaries. And so it's really hard right now to tell you, since we have not written the script for the one that we're going to be hopefully showing at IC11, we don't have that completed yet. So until we have a script for that particular documentary, it's hard to tell how long these are going to be. But I would say that they can be anywhere from 5 minutes, you know, for just some really short ones and stuff. And generally you don't want to go more than about 40, 45 minutes. Because people's attention span just can't handle it. So you need to be able to do shorter ones and make them more powerful, and you can always have part one and part two and part three and et cetera. David, do you want to add something to that?
Well, just that you and I had talked about doing some of those shorter pieces and sticking them on YouTube, so that there's maybe one short little piece about Sepphoris, or one short little piece about the Sea of Galilee, or a short little piece that illustrates one of Jesus' parables. There's just a whole range of little shorts that can be stuck on some resource such as YouTube.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that everyone who heard you read The Galilean can give you, there's a perfect example of how that could be turned into a documentary or into a short film. You can see all of those. If you have the whole thing in filmmaking, when I used to give seminars, in fact, I just gave one this past year in Florida, one of the first things that I said in the seminar was to other filmmakers was, it's all about the story, stupid, because that's what it's about. If you have a powerful story, then you're basically just filling in the blocks at that point. If you have a really good story, you can do anything. And so that's what's going to be one of the hardest things, is to make sure that the stories that we have are factual and exciting and inspirational.
Well put.
Very well put. And, you know, friends, we are down to our last couple of minutes now. I want to thank you guys so much for this wonderful show. Again, I want to reiterate that you can support this incredible project by going to the website that David and Eric have created, and I highly recommend and encourage you to do that if you're going to do that. David, what's the site again?
It's joshuabenjoseph.org, and it's joshua-ben-joseph.org, not underscore, those are dashes in there. And they can get more information on the project. And as we move forward here, we'll be posting more and more of what we're doing. I do have a closing quote I can read here, Paula, when you get to that point.
Yes, please do that. And I have a little something, and we'll end on that. And
maybe
I want to thank you again, Carol.
To add? Okay.
No, I'm fine. Go ahead,
okay.
David.
Eric, thank you. Carol, thank you so much for coming on. I hope you come back. I'd love to do a show with you. And David, thank you.
Shall I read this quote here? The religious challenge of this age is to those far-seeing and forward-looking men and women of spiritual insight who will dare to construct a new and appealing philosophy of living out of the enlarged and exquisitely integrated modern concepts of cosmic truth, universe beauty, and divine goodness. Such a new and righteous vision of morality will attract all that is good in the mind of man and challenge that which is best in the human soul. The real purpose of all universe education is to effect the better coordination of the isolated child of the worlds with the larger realities of his expanding experience.
Wow.
Beautiful. And here's one written by a Christian, I'm sure, and it's one that I cherish, and this is for our master, Joshua ben Joseph, Jesus of Nazareth, Christ Michael of Nebadon. One solitary life. He was born in an obscure village. He worked in a carpenter shop until he was 30. He became an itinerant preacher. He never held an office. He never had a family or owned a house. He didn't go to college. He had no credentials but himself. 20 centuries have come and gone, and today he is the central figure of the human race. All the armies that ever marched, and all the navies that ever sailed, all the parliaments that ever sat, and all the kings that ever reigned, have not affected the life of man on this earth as much as that one solitary life. Thanks again, my friends, and I hope you tune back in often. We're on every Saturday, The Cosmic Citizen on Blog Talk Radio. Thanks to my guests, Eric Kosh and David Kanner and Carol Setters. Thank you, my dear. And I hope to talk to you guys soon. And I thank our
listeners. Thank you, Paula.
Yes. Thank you, Paula.
Merry Christmas, everyone. You're welcome. Thank you. And next week and the week after that, it's Christmas and New Year's. We'll be playing some of our favorite shows, but we won't be doing a show. We'll be back again early in 2011. This is The Cosmic Citizen. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the host, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.